Hello and welcome to Talking You Retina, the official podcast of the European Society of Retina Specialists. I'm Jonathan McCrae. In this podcast, we bring you expert discussions and interviews with leaders from the world of retina and beyond. We'll also keep you up to date with the latest news from the Society. In this episode, we take a closer look at a provocative paper in Cell that links bacteria that we typically find in the gut with inherited eye diseases such as LCA and RP via the gene CRB1. Before we hear from our faculty, a note that the deadline for results of clinical trials and the late-breaking sessions for Uretina in Barcelona is Wednesday, 19th of June. Registration is, of course, open for the Congress. You can get your tickets online at uretina.org. And, of course, the price of tickets is cheaper if you are a Uretina member. We'd love to hear your suggestions for topics for this podcast or comments on what you've heard. You can email us podcast@uretina.org. Now, on to our scientific discussion. I'm delighted to be joined by Bart Leroy. He's from Ghent University Hospital and Ghent University, as well as Mark Panisi, who's Director of Ophthalmic Genetics at the Retina Foundation in Dallas and a Professor of Ophthalmology at the Casey Eye Institute in Portland, Oregon. Bart, it's great to have you back on the podcast and such an interesting subject. Over to you.
Thank you, Jonathan. And this is indeed an article that was published very recently in Cell. It's called CRB1-associated retinal degeneration is dependent on bacterial translocation from the gut by colleagues mostly from China. Super interesting paper, I think. And I'd love to discuss this with my friend and colleague, Mark Panisi. Unfortunately, we couldn't get Isabel today, but I'm sure she has good ideas, but we'll talk through these ideas put forward by the paper with Mark Panisi, who is in Texas and Oregon. Mark, what do you think about what these authors present? You've read the paper, I've read the paper, I'm sure many of our colleagues have read the paper. What are your first thoughts on what these studies show?
Well, first off, thank you, Bart. It's a pleasure to be here today to discuss this paper with you. And I thought it was a very interesting paper with, you know, some very intriguing hypothesis and quite a lot of experiments to back up the thoughts. So, you know, just by way of background, I think as an inherited retinal degeneration specialist like you, we've all seen patients with mutations in CRB1, one of the more common genes to cause Leber congenital amaurosis. And I think it's one of the ones that's quite unique in that it has a phenotype that you can often recognize even before genetic testing, which sets it apart from some of the other genetic diseases that we see. And certainly that made me open to the concept that maybe there is a novel pathology involved, since it does look quite different from other retinal degenerations. And I think the central thesis here is that CRB1 originally, which was discovered, I think, in the Drosophila and thought to play a role in the polarity of cells and cellular migration, may have a role also in the barrier, specifically the retinal blood barrier, as well as they've shown now that it is expressed in the gut and may play a role in bacteria entering systemic circulation and then ending up in the retina, and that this might actually be influencing the pathology. And they look at this in several different ways. First off is in knockout mice, which have been introduced with different bacteria, and they show that you can actually improve the phenotype in the retina by treating these animals with antibiotics or growing them in a germ-free environment. Or that if you restore CRB1 in the gut, you can also alleviate the phenotype. So this is a really interesting kind of novel mechanism that bacterial translocation to the retina could impact pathology. So, you know, I think we have to start off with a little bit of skepticism since it is such a novel idea, but I think it's very interesting and worth exploring. What do you think, Bart?
I agree in the sense that we obviously would need more data. We have seen the data in the mouse now, an RD8 mouse, which is a naturally occurring model for the CRB1 IRD. if you think back, and we'll circle back to the paper, but if you think about the IRD that is caused by CRB1, you and me and Isabel and many other IRD experts know that we recognize this, as you said, as a quite a specific condition. And it's one of those that I would call the most pseudo-inflammatory of IRDs, in the sense that you often have a hyperemic optic disc, you have a thickened retina. If you look at the blue light autofluorescence, you often see that there is some hyper intensity or hyper autofluorescence surrounding the blood vessels. And so you could imagine yourself like, hang on, there is something that has an inflammatory aspect. And obviously inflammation goes hand in hand with infection. The other thing that I would want to bring to the table in the discussion with someone like you, because you may have experienced the same thing, but I, for one, have certainly met a couple of patients with CRB1-related IRD who happened to first have been treated for quite some time by uveitis experts. And so we all know that there is some overlap between uveitis and between IRD world. And I've picked up, together with my colleague Julie Desaitet, at least three people from the uveitis clinics who eventually turn out to be CRB1-related disease patients. So I don't know what your thoughts are on the fact that this hypothesis, being a very novel idea, proven beautifully in the mouse model. I think the logic of this paper and the buildup of this paper and the experiments shown merit the fact that it's published in Cell. Obviously, this is in a mouse model. But what does the pseudo-inflammatory aspect, if you agree with that, of the IRD caused by biallelic mutations in CRB1 tell you about the fact that this could also be true in humans?
Yeah, you know, I agree. You know, once again, when you think about the phenotype in CRB1, and you know, another thing that is quite common is cystoid macular edema in those patients, and often quite severe, which, you know, could also go along with an inflammatory origin. And we still don't really understand cystoid macular edema in inherited retinal degenerations, but you know, one theory is that it has to do with the RPE. You know, maybe the RPE is not pumping sufficiently, but you could also imagine that if you have a breakdown of the RPE barrier, that could contribute to accumulation of fluid in the macula, which would sort of support this mechanism of action. Now, you know, what I don't, you know is, you know, can we explain the full CRB1 phenotype? You know, is there a degenerative component on top of an inflammatory component, or is this just a inflammatory component? And I think we're somewhat limited there in terms of the mouse model is not a perfect model of the disease, right? This is can be a pan-retinal dystrophy, but it also can be somewhat more focused on the macula in some patients. And mice not having a macula don't exactly make a good model for that. You know, the other thing is, when you look at the mouse model, the changes in the retina with these rosettes and pseudo rosettes really isn't the exact same, you know, phenotype that we see in patients when we look at OCT and we see loss of the laminations of the retina that kind of suggests a more of a cellular migration, you know, problem. So I think it's possible there could be two different things going on. You could still have a retinal dystrophy or dysplasia from lack of CRB1 playing a role in cellular migration. And then, you know, it's possible there could be superimposed on top of that an inflammatory component. Now, you know, I don't know, do you think we're at a point where we should try to treat patients with antibiotics as they did with the mice?
It's obviously one thing, like you so beautifully stated initially, is the fact that the experiments done by the authors include the fact that RDH mice were treated with antibiotics and they got better. It's obviously, what they also did was do gene therapy just applied to the gut. And obviously that's a whole act to follow, a much more difficult act to follow in a human being. So testing with broad spectrum antibiotics, and they did use quite a cocktail of broad spectrums, I would say. But that would be the first thing that you could try out. Would I try it? Well, I would do it within the framework of a study, potentially. I would first need to discuss that through with people like yourselves and obviously with the patients involved, an ethical committee. I would certainly do it within the framework of a proper study rather than saying, oh, we've got arguments, let's try and do this in the clinic. I think our patients would only benefit from proper randomized clinical trials, I think.
Yeah.
The other thing I would assume is if we were to have pathology from an eye of a CRB1 patient, that would be a very good thing because we could then have a look for specific markers for the presence of what are bacteria, obviously. You touched upon the fact that CRB1-related disease in human beings is macular predominant. There are indeed macular dystrophies, isolated macular dystrophies, at least in the beginning of the evolution of disease, that have been described. I published, but there's quite a few who published on this. Obviously, the macula not being present in mice makes for what we see in the humans not being perfectly reflected in the mouse model. And so I think we need to probably go further, try and see whether we could have CRB1-related disease in other animals that would more likely mimic us. The first things I would think about is talk to our DVM colleagues and see whether they would have any models in the dog that are either spontaneously occurring or lab-made. Because those dogs obviously mimic us a little bit better than mice do.
Yeah, I what I'd like to see is go back to the Drosophila where this was originally discovered. You know, the gene was first described in Drosophila, and see if you could do somewhat corresponding experiments, because it's a very different organism. The retina has very different structure, and I think that's where they worked out some of the initial, defects, and that might help give added evidence as to whether or not this is truly due to bacterial translocation versus, cellular migration, or even both. And, I think once again we have to be very careful with the mouse phenotype, right? Because these yellow dots that you see in the mouse retina, are not completely the same as what we see in humans. And, there's actually a history of this where this CRB1 naturally occurring mutation actually contaminated a lot of different mouse lines. And there were a lot of publications related to age-related macular degeneration models where people were attributing relationships to certain genes based on the appearance of these yellow dots that actually ended up just being due to the contamination of this CRB1, mutation. And so it's very possible that this bacterial translocation hypothesis is true for the appearance of these yellow dots or rosettes in the mouse, but that may or may not connect to the human condition. And I think that really depends on how much we really think that this mouse retinal phenotype actually corresponds to the human condition. So yeah, I agree. Like looking at it in other species would be very supportive. If you could, sort of reproduce that in another, species, that would definitely increase my desire to maybe run a human trial where we looked at something like that. But I mean, I think at least from a first, approach, we could just look at our patients and see if there's a history of colitis or other GI disturbances, in our patients with CRB1 mutations, you know, just from an epidemiological point, that might reveal something.
Yeah, I think a GI questionnaire or a series of questions that are focused on how function of the gut would be disturbed in such patients would make a lot of sense. And so I think it's safe to say that we would be able to recommend, if you agree, to anybody listening to this podcast, to focus on inflammatory conditions or disturbances of gastrointestinal function, mostly focused on the colon, because that would be interesting. And then what are your feelings about the solidity of the data? Is the solidity of the data presented in this paper in a model that definitely doesn't perfectly reflect the human model? Are these data enough for you to then say, I would probably try it out within a small pilot study that would be focusing on CRB1 patients, probably those patients who still have a retina that wouldn't be totally destroyed? Because obviously if you were to start with patients with a severe LCA, where light perception vision or not even light perception would be the case, you sure are not you're not going to be able to save a lot. But would you consider people with the milder end of the spectrum disease of CRB1 related IRD, would you consider treating such patients for a couple of years and then look at the outcomes? You would obviously have to compare them to similar patients who are not treated, but would you think the data are good enough or not yet?
I would say not yet, you know, for me. I mean, especially when you look at the antibiotic regimen that they needed, it was four different antibiotics. You're talking about sterilizing the gut, which, you know, would have its own side effects and implications, right? You deprive the gut of its own flora, you could have a lot of potential, you know, side effects, such as, you know, overgrowth of a very undesirable, you know, bacteria. You know, putting patients on massive antibiotics like that for a long period of time could lead to, you know, resistant, you know, species of bacteria that could actually do more harm than good. So I would like to really see more data, you know, at least some replication of this in another model. And I think we need a little bit better understanding of it. But, you know, once again, I think it's intriguing and, you know, it has prompted me to kind of think a little more about this concept of, you know, bacterial translocation to the retina, even in other inherited retinal degenerations, because we know that other patients with RP can have breakdown of the blood retinal barrier. So, you know, could it be that even in patients without CRB1 mutations, if there is a breakdown of blood retinal barrier, could bacteria be getting in there and prompting an innate immune response and maybe driving some inflammation and contributing to the degeneration? So there could be even broader, you know, implications, you know, of this theory. Now, I think we have to be very careful to kind of separate out, you know, correlation. You know, if we go and biopsy the retinas of many patients, we may see there are bacteria. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, causative, but it's something to worth thinking about.
The last thing I would want to say in that respect, Mark, would be obviously having hematogenic spread of bacteria that then would potentially get into the retina and cause lesions consequent upon blood retinal brain or blood brain retinal barrier, whatever you want to call it, and they then seep into or get into the retina to do their destruction. Obviously, getting those bacteria first in the systemic circulation requires a port of entry. And so we would then also need, obviously, it would be interesting to look at retinal degenerations or whether that be inherited or not, like you said, but you would still need a port of entry because we don't normally have a lot of bacteria swimming around in our systemic circulation, which was, I think, unique in this paper where they showed that there is hematogenic spread of bacteria. The number of bacteria being present is higher because of the fact that there's this breakdown of the integrity of the gastrointestinal wall at the level of the colon. The other thing that I immediately thought of was, would it be interesting? I'll say it this way. I probably would have a low trigger if I were to talk to a CRB1 IRD patient who would tell me that he or she has gastrointestinal issues. I would probably be more inclined now than ever before to talk to a gastroenterologist to go and do a gastroscopy or a colonoscopy and maybe actually get some biopsies and see whether we couldn't. I wouldn't do it in patients who don't have complaints. I think that would be unethical, unless you do it within a study and people are agreeing to it. But if there would be a patient who says, yeah, you know, I have frequent infections, I have disturbances, I don't feel well often at the gastroenterological level or gastrointestinal level, I would probably be inclined to say, let's talk to a GI expert and get a biopsy. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I'd be really curious to know what our gastroenterology colleagues would think about this paper as two ophthalmologists. I'm not sure we're totally qualified to talk about the gut.
It's maybe something we ought to do, to talk to people whom we know in the GI world and see what they think. And to wrap it up, what are your final thoughts on this paper, Mark? What is the take-home message for you when you read the paper?
Well, once again, I think it's very intriguing, and I think it's hypothesis generating. You know, it certainly has prompted me to think about what other things we should go to look for to maybe confirm this theory. You know, certainly what we've seen in animal models, and to determine, you know, whether or not this really applies to humans.
Yeah. Correct, Mark. I fully agree. And I think we need to look out for novel, larger animal models that are more related to us than the mouse. I think we have to probably ask questions directed towards GI integrity and function in patients. And we certainly have seen a very novel hypothesis that was brought about in a paper that I think has some solid signs in there. It's not a study that, or not a series of studies that they've done in 1 month. So it's a solid paper. It certainly merits further investigation. And with that, Mark, thank you so much, because you are one of the leading the world experts in IRD. And it's always a pleasure to discuss this with you. And so to the audience, thank you very much from both of us for listening. And with that, back to Jonathan.
Well, thank you, Bart, because that was a fascinating discussion. And Mark, of course, for your wonderful contribution as well. It is really interesting, this paper, and curious I am to see where it will all lead. But of course, larger models, as you say, bigger studies and more research required, as is often the case with the most intriguing of papers. Just to say that this podcast was a joint initiative of EURETINA in collaboration with ERNI, the European Reference Network for Rare Eye Disease. So thanks to those. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back with more Talking EURETINA in your podcast feed in a couple of weeks. I'm Jonathan McRae. I'll see you next time.